All right, perfect timing. We are back and joined by our good pal Mike Plume. Good to talk to you, sir. How are you?
Hey, man, what's happening?
Not much. We're sitting around playing Guy Clark songs, and I know you're a fan, right?
I am. Yeah.
When did you become?
That's what I'm saying.
When did you become a fan? I guess is what I'm getting at. Like when did you discover the magic of the Guy Clark?
Well, you're gonna have to let me know if my phone cuts out because I'm just sort of sitting in my car here, so I hope it doesn't. We're at my daughter's birthday party right now.
Oh yeah, happy birthday, Ruby! How old is she now?
Her birthday is not until July, but we will be long gone by the time her birthday rolls around. So everybody here in town is throwing a big birthday party for her.
All right. For those who haven't heard, Mike is heading back to Canada. You're going back to Edmonton, all right?
I am indeed. Yep.
After being in exile in Nashville for many years.
After plying my trade in obscurity in Nashville for many, many years.
You've done all right. I know you've done some writing down there.
Oh, even though I haven't had like massive success, I have a sneaking suspicion I may be the exception to the rule. You know what I mean? I think I've somehow carved out a living since 1987. So I'm very, very lucky to have been able to even accomplish that. So
yeah,
there's not a day that goes by where I don't go, you know what, man? I'm kind of lucky, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, you could certainly, the glass is half full, you could certainly look at it either way, but
yeah,
I refuse to look at it any other way.
Yeah.
You know, so Guy Clark, you know, I'm trying to think, like, I'd heard L.A. Freeway, but I'm not sure if I knew who Guy Clark was at that point. But the first time I remember reading about him would have been at when I'm reading an article on Townes Van Zandt's funeral.
Uh-huh.
That would have been the first time where that was like in 1997. But, you know, I mean, who didn't? I mean, I knew Poncho and Lefty.
Yeah.
I'd known that since 1980. I would have been like 12 years old or something. And I knew, Tecumseh Valley was another song that I remember. And I remember If I Needed You. Just from hearing that, like, I don't know who would have covered that song. Did Don Williams cover one of those? Which ones did he cover? I don't even know.
Yeah, I don't remember.
If I Needed You, I think he might have covered that song.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. But so, like, I'd known his songs talking about Townes Van Zandt. So like Townes and Guy were both sort of these guys who, you know, just a 12-year-old kid's not going to know, but he's going to know the songs.
Yeah.
I mean, so I've always kind of lived with the Townes Van Zandt songs and the Guy Clark songs, as I'm sure you did.
Absolutely.
But, you know, maybe neither of us realized who it was other than Don Williams and Emmylou Harris cover, you know, a song,
right,
you know,
yep,
or whatever.
Yep.
But so Guy Clark, I think the first time I really started reading about Guy Clark, and this is, I mean, it's embarrassing because it seems like it came so late to the party, like 1996, 1997, something like that. You know? So that was when I first kind of heard of him. I mean, then when we moved to Nashville, there was a lot of people in the songwriting. I mean, obviously Guy Clark is, by the time I got to Nashville, Townes Van Zandt had passed away probably a year before that. So Guy was like the guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was exactly what, he was the denim on denim guy, like the carpenter. He just had that look. And I remember first time I ever saw him play was in Texas. We were doing, we had played a couple of shows there and we were on the road with Eagle Smith.
Yeah.
And then he was doing a show with Guy Clark and, I don't know, Jack Ingram and a couple other guys at this place in Dallas. The ranch where they shot the TV show, Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? What's it called? South Fork?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was right there, like it, at the mansion. So they had this big festival there.
Wow.
The Guy Clark was there. And I think Robert Earl Keane was there. So there was a lot of guys who I was already like really familiar with and really excited to see. And I knew who Guy Clark was by this point because I'd already had, I think Keepers was probably the first album of his that I bought. This was just a live album, which is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But, and so I feel like I'm rambling, so I apologize for that. But what struck me was the way he sort of walked on stage, the same way like a carpenter would sort of show up at work.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's like, I'm here to do a job.
Yeah. Roll up his sleeves.
Yeah, man, and it's just light
the
a smoke.
First thing you do, yeah.
Put in the ashtray, take a drag off a cigarette and have a drink, and then just proceeded to just, you know, blow everybody away. And now I was this. I mean, everybody else, seemingly everybody else in the crowd. Oh, it was Texas for starters. So everybody else knew who Guy was.
Yeah.
And he was the headliner, and he closed the show, and he was just out there with his guitar. I think Vernon was playing with him. I don't really remember. It was a long time ago now. But it was just, you know, Guy and his guitar and another guy playing with him. I'm sure it was Vernon.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's got these perfect songs. I don't know. It's just, like, his songs just sound, and again, you know, his approach to songwriting is very workmanlike and very much like a carpenter.
Yep.
You know, making a chair, making
That's
a
right.
table, making something. Or, I mean, well, he built guitars as much as he wrote songs in the last 30 years of his life. You
yep.
know what I mean?
Yep.
So he really had that approach to songwriting, which was just make it as good as you can possibly make it. But I'm not really saying anything that anybody listening right now doesn't already know. You know what I mean? I don't really have any, as far as like that, my first encounter with Guy Clark, it was just like everybody else's. It was like, this is the real deal. This is kind of like he, there was never a wasted word in his songs. You know, pack up all your dishes, make a note of all good wishes. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
You know, there's no need for anything else. You know exactly what he's talking about.
That's right.
It's just, I don't know. He's great. So sorry for rambling like that,
no.
But I guess my first experience would have been around 90. You know, well, Towns Van Zandt died on New Year's Day, 1997, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And so it would have been, you know, a week after that. I read an article, and they said, you know, Guy Clark, sang a couple songs at the funeral. And
yep.
I don't know if you've ever seen footage of the funeral where Guy walks on stage and he says, I booked this gig 30 years ago.
Yep.
but that's kind of my first brush with Guy Clark.
Yeah. But not your most interesting brush with Guy Clark.
No.
So tell us your story, which is always amusing.
Well, so for me, I had a publishing deal in Nashville, and I this was back in 2001. In November of 2001, I had a publishing deal, and we had just hired, and my publisher had just gotten this new guy, and he was really, really out to impress all the writers that he was representing. And I had really only just met him like maybe a couple of weeks before, and he was really eager. He seemed to be very, very well connected in the music industry. He said, if there's anybody you could write with in Nashville, who would it be? And I said, Guy Clark. Thinking, you know, it's like saying, well, if there's anybody you could, you know, play guitar for, I think I'd probably like to play on Heartbreak Hotel when Elvis was recording. You know what I mean? It was like,
yeah.
it was that far-fetched.
Yeah.
And I just kind of left it at that and just thinking, like everybody in the music industry, thinking, oh, here's another big talker, Betty Crocker, and this isn't going to pan out, but I'm just going to, just going to shoot for the moon and see what happens. And Christ, like, two or three days later, I'm writing a song with a buddy of mine, and I get a phone call at this publishing house that I'm at and say, hey, Mike, you want it on the phone? So I go to the front desk, the receptionist, and grab the phone. And I pick up the phone, and it's this new publisher, and he says, write this number down. I said, oh, okay. I said, why? And he goes, you got to call it right now. I said, okay, who is it? He says, it's Guy Clark. He's expecting your call. Can you believe that? I mean, that's the most far-fetched thing. I mean, right now, anybody who's listening to the show right now, who's never heard this story, is thinking, why? I'm going to switch channels. Please don't. But anyway, so that's kind of what happened. He's like, yeah, it's Guy Clark, and he's expecting your call. So I put the number in my pocket, and I finished the writing session with this buddy of mine, who was also a big Guy Clark fan. I said, I think I'm going to write with Guy Clark soon. I got his phone number. He goes, you're kidding. I said, no, man. So next thing I know, it took me probably 6 hours to get the courage up to call him. Because what do you say? What are you going to say? This is about as this is as you know, much of a flyer of a phone call as you could take it. Like, I felt like a telemarketer. Like, what am I going to say? Hi, guy, I'm going to write songs with you. You know what I mean? It's like, it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So anyway, needless to say, I finally got around to calling him. Phone rang. Hello. I said, hi, is Guy Clark here? He goes, speaking. I said, Guy, this is Mike Plume. And, oh, hey, Mike, I'm expecting your call. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know? So anyway, my publisher obviously said something, right? So anyway, I book a gig, and I said, you know, my publisher said that he was talking with your publisher, and they thought that maybe we could, maybe, you know, make up a song or something. He goes, I think that would be a really good idea. But what was funny is, like, as soon as he answered the phone, I knew it was Guy Clark because it was his voice. You know what I mean? It's like calling Tom Waits. You know, you don't have to ask, but hey, is Tom there?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know right out of the gate, that's Guy Clark. Yeah, that's Tom Waits.
Did you ever see that salsa commercial a couple of years ago with his voice? Like, every time I saw that commercial, I was like, oh, my God, Guy Clark is selling me salsa.
No.
Did you ever see that? It was the craziest thing.
No, I never saw that at all. No.
Yeah, it was paste picante sauce or something. It was Guy.
Well, I hope he paid the bills with that.
I bet.
Sure he did.
Sorry.
So anyway, I call him up, and we book a little writing appointment. And I'm beside myself. I call my wife. Well, we weren't married at the time, but I called Jenny, and I said, you're not going to believe who I'm writing songs with next week. And she goes, I'm writing with Guy Clark. And so anyway, we're very excited by that. And anyway, short story long, the next three or four days before I was to write with Guy, a friend of mine rolls into town and calls me up and says, hey, I have 2 extra tickets, front row at the Ryman Auditorium, to see John Hyatt, Lyle Lovett, Joe Ely, and Guy Clark. Do you want to go? And I thought, yeah, let me think about that. Yes. Let me check my schedule. Yeah, no, we're good.
I think I can make that work.
Yeah, I think we can work that out. So Jenny and I show up at the Ryman Auditorium, and I don't remember the exact date, but we show up, and the 4 guys walk on stage, and it was just the greatest show. How bad could it be?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Lyle Lovett and John Hyatt and Ely and obviously Guy Clark. But what was interesting, like Hyatt would play a song, and it was fantastic. He played, like, I don't know, Icy Blue Heart or something like that, which is an absolute career song. I mean, if anybody else wrote it, you wouldn't have to write anything else because it'd be like, that's just a perfect song.
That's right.
And then, you know, then Lyle would play If I Had a Boat or something, and Joe Ely was doing, like, I don't know what I can't even think what it was. I mean, he Road Goes On Forever or something. Yeah. I mean, these guys are just playing these great songs. But when Guy would play, the 3 guys, the other 3 gentlemen sitting on stage, you could tell that they were, like, in their opinion, they're at the feet of the master.
Yep.
You could see the respect that Hyatt, Lovett, and Ely had for Guy Clark.
Absolutely.
And, like, to the point where they're just, like, they're singing along with every word that he's saying because they knew these songs like the back of their hand. They grew up in these songs. They tore these songs apart to figure out how to make a song. Same way, like, a guy tears, you know, a guy who's interested in tinkering with motors will tear apart a motor and learn how that motor works. You could tell that these songwriters, Lovett and Ely and Hyatt, you could tell that they tore down Guy Clark's songs to learn how these songs work. And it was fascinating. I was as fascinated watching him as I was by watching Guy Clark. Just, you know, they were just singing along to everything, and, you know, not like, just kind of singing under their breath. They're not like stealing the microphone. You probably saw that tour anyway.
Absolutely.
Didn't they play them with it?
3 times. Well, I went to Alberta to see it twice, and then they came here after that.
Yeah. So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
So it was great. And then 3 days later, I'm knocking on the front door of Guy Clark's place. I'm writing this.
Yeah.
And I can't even, so I pull up with my guitar, and I bought, like, a 6-pack of Diet Coke. But I wasn't really sure what the hell I was going to get myself into over there. But I show up at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I knock on the door. He opens the door, and there's Guy Clark. I can't even believe it. And so I walk in the front door, and he sticks his hand out. He's a tall dude. Did you ever meet him?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he's certainly a very, I wouldn't say imposing figure, but he strikes a... He's a tall gentleman, and he just, you could just, you know.
Yeah.
He's like the old lion. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So he said hi and come on in. And I walk in, and the first thing I see when I walk in the front door is the Stardust album cover. The Willie Nelson Stardust album cover.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Quarter Moon in a 10-Cent Town. It was one of the two. But it didn't say Emmylou Harris, Quarter Moon in a 10-Cent Town. It was the painting for Quarter Moon in a 10-Cent Town. And I remember thinking, did she, you know what, I think, that's right, Susanna Clark is a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Christ, she painted these things, man. And so I'm just stunned by this. It's a big painting. It's like, you know, 2 feet by 2 feet or something like that, or you know, even bigger than that. So a nice size painting, maybe 3 by 3. And I'm just stunned, and I'm looking at this, like, I can't even look, and I walk up to Clark, I'm thinking, okay, when I get home, I'm gonna dig up the Willie Nelson Stardust CD, and I gotta verify this. And anyway, obviously we know exactly what the answer is. Yes.
Yeah.
She painted that. And so then I walked in, I look at that painting, and I'm stunned by it. And I hang a left and start walking down the hall, and the next thing I see is the Stardust album cover. I can't remember whether it was Stardust that I saw first or Quarter Moon in 10-Cent Town, but they were both there, like within 5 feet of each other, just around the corner.
Yeah.
And it was like, I remember thinking, these guys, this is something. I mean, these guys, none of them, I mean, they are true artists. They are songwriters. They are painters. They're just, and they're just as good as it gets. I remember that. I remember thinking, well, I'm way beyond my element. This is ridiculous,
yeah.
You know. But so we went, and then we walked around the corner, and then Suzanne is there having a cup of coffee, smoking a cigarette, and a guy introduces me to her and says, "Hey, this is Mike, and well, this is my wife, Susanna." And I remember the first thing I'm thinking, "Oh, Susanna, don't you cry, baby." I mean, you can't help it, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's like my hair was standing on end by this point. And then she says, "You guys, you all writing today?" And she said, yeah, we're going to go down and get at it. And she said, "Well, break some hearts, boys, break some hearts." I mean, if that isn't the support that you want from your spouse when you're going off to work, then you don't know what life's about.
Yeah.
Because that to me is just like, this is a couple who are very supportive of each other. It was just one of those great things. It was like, you know, just that break some hearts, boys. It was like, you know, you could just tell the affection that they had for each other in that line. It was just mm-hmm. It was just a beautiful thing. Anyway, so we go downstairs and then there's a couple other paintings. The album cover where there's a painting of his old blue shirt.
That's right.
These things about that was there on the cover. So we go down and then you're down in his shop and I am sorry I'm making the story so long. We don't have a commercial break coming up.
No, you got time. Don't you worry.
Okay. Brought to you by Michelob. When there's no other beer left, drink Michelob. So now we're in trouble. Anyway, we hung around and we were like in his studio and I walked in and the first thing I saw was like, you know, like a carpenter's bench. And, you know, there's a couple of them, there's a guitar that he was working on, and there was a bunch of a wall full of cassettes and a picture of Towns Van Zandt on the wall. And, you know, just,
yep.
It was just, and you could tell it was a carpenter's, it was Guy's workshop.
Yeah.
And it was great. And all these carpenter's pencils, those flat pencils and stuff, stacks of, you know, yellow lined paper, you know, pads of that stuff. And a big ashtray, like the size of a hubcap, and so we were looking at the guitars, and he had a couple hanging on the wall, and one that he was working on, and he said, you know, these things will be the death of me, and that kind of stuck in my head because up until that point, for the week leading up to my writing appointment with him, I couldn't think of anything to write. I was thinking, what could I possibly show up? Guy Clark's, what could I bring to Guy Clark's place and say, here's a song I'm thinking of working on? You know what I mean? There's nothing you could bring to the table that in my opinion, he wouldn't say, yeah, no, let's not even bother with that. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, and I talked myself out of a million different song ideas that I brought to the table. And, but when he said the guitars will be the death of me, I thought, okay, and this, that's a pretty good idea. So anyway, we sit down and We we pull out our guitars and we each light up a cigarette. He says, "Well, do you have any ideas?" And I says, "I got one." I said, "Yeah, guitars will be the death of me." And kind of with that, we were off and running. And then somewhere else, he just sort of talked. A lot of songwriting sessions in Nashville are the ones that I enjoy. You don't necessarily pull out a guitar as soon as you get there. You don't really do anything. You just sort of talk.
Yeah.
And just sort of go back and forth and just make small talk and, shoot the shit. And then next thing you know, somebody will say something. And you go, "That's a good idea for a song." And so I said, "Yeah, you said it earlier about the guitars will be the death." He goes, "Yeah, well, that's the best job I've ever had, man. So I don't know what else." I'm thinking, okay, we've got to marry these together.
Yeah.
And that was probably the only thing that I brought to the table on that song. After that, he just kind of wrote it. And I was just there documenting the thing. But and we just had a lot of fun. And he wrote probably 15 pages of lyrics for that song and sort of kept whittling it down. And when he gets going, man, he would just chain smoke and he would just write and write and write. He would just lines, line after line. And they weren't always rhyming. He would just come up with line after line after line. He would go back and find lines that rhymed within the 75 pages, well, not 75 pages,
yeah.
but, four or five pages of lyrics that he wrote, he would go in and sort of start piecing them together and try to make them flow. It was interesting watching him do that. And I remember we started talking about how, you can never treat a guitar like it's magic.
Right.
And what's that?
Yeah.
And I think I probably told you that part. He said, "You can never treat a guitar like it's magic, because as soon as you do that, the magic leaves it."
Oh.
Mm. Oh, I thought, oh, my God, man. Should have wrote that song, too.
Yeah.
But we didn't. But I just, that was like hanging out at Obi-Wan Kenobi's place. Man.
Yeah.
That just blew me away. I'm thinking, did he just make that up? Or was that like something he has like on his refrigerator that he looks at every morning? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he would say stuff like, he says, "It's just a tool, man. Guitar is just a tool. That's all it is." He says, "Don't treat a guitar like it's magic. The minute you do, the magic leaves it. It's just a tool to help you tell the truth, man, to help you get your point across. That's all it is." He says, "You ever see a carpenter with a pristine, brand new, never used hammer?" No, because the hammer is just the tool to help the guy build the bookcase that he wants to build, to help the guy build the staircase that he needs to build,
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah,
or the table. It had nothing to do with the hammer, And I remember, I carry that with me to this day.
Yeah,
because it was just one of those. I mean, yeah, because we buy guitars, it's like Nigel Tufnell, like, don't even point at that guitar. You know what I mean? Because we get like that. We're so precious with guitars, there are people who won't buy Gibson guitars anymore because they believe they're just geared for lawyers to buy.
Yeah.
They can hang them on their wall.
Right.
They're not really trying to make guitars for working musicians anymore,
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like, that was just powerful, powerful stuff. It's just a tool. And he said, and then the other line that he said, not a line, the other story he told me, he used to forever give his wife, Suzanne, he said he'd give her a hard time because she would never clean her brushes after she was done painting for the day.
Yeah.
And she would say, "The brushes? Screw the brushes. I can buy more brushes."
Yeah.
It's what's going on the canvas that matters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's just a good way. You're like, try not to, basically it's like, try not to lose the plot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, if you're working on a song, you're working on a song. You're not really overly concerned about your guitar. And he also said that about Towns too. He said Towns didn't care about what guitar he played just as long as he had one.
Right.
You know, he would say he would just lose them wherever. Usually playing, dice somewhere or poker or something.
Yep.
And I'll tell you another funny story. Before years before I had even I had the chance to write with Guy, Eagle Smith had done a tour with him, and he said, in fact, Fred probably told me this story when we were at the South Fork Ranch. In Dallas at that show, but he says, he goes, "Man, whatever you do, if you're ever hanging out with a guy, don't gamble with them. So, and that mental note, thinking, well, not that I'll ever get a chance to write with them, but if I ever do, remember hanging out with them, I want to make sure that I don't gamble. So anyway, at some point during the day, he says, out of the blue, he says, how much you got in your pocket? I said, and I knew what was coming. And I said, like $12. He said, I'll flip you for it. Isn't that great?
So did you do it?
No, I didn't. I should have. Maybe we'll change the story. Yes, I did, and I lost the house. No, I didn't. I wouldn't do it. It's not like he tried to convince me. He just said,
yeah.
He just asked me the one time, I'll flip you for it.
Yeah.
And I said, man, I got it. Like $12. And then but he said the green. I said, you know, he says, it ain't if it's not the mortgage, it ain't gambling. If it's not seriously going to affect your life, to the good or to the bad, it's not gambling. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
That's a way to justify things.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that all unfolded. We had a great time with that. And I had another guy sort of from that same day. I don't remember what it was. Something to do with the gambling. I don't know. It was just a great. I got home that night and I said, "Jeez, Jenny, you don't even. I can't even believe what I just went through. I mean, it was like everything just became like tunnel vision. It was like, and then 10 hours went by in felt like in 5 minutes. It was one of those days I'll never ever forget.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you letting me sort of tell you the story.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Did you ever get to hang out with him again or see him again, or was that pretty much
yes,
it?
Yes, I did. Did I tell you that story too?
I don't think so.
Okay, so here's a good story. So we finished guitars are the best job I ever had. And he says, we should let this ferment for a couple months, which is something since then, I shall serve no song with the exception of my Stomp and Tom song, which I kind of, that sort of unfolded quickly. But I usually will sit on the song for, sometimes I'll write a song and I won't release it for, 4 or 5 years. But,
yeah.
But sometimes I'll write it, but, more often than not, I'll start a song and it won't necessarily be finished for a year, year and a half. I'll just sort of let it sit. I would say 95% of the songs that I write will ferment on the shelf for a year, year and a half, 2 years sometimes.
Yeah.
I'll keep trotting them out until they sort of start to feel right.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pay it, like I'll record it and then I'll listen to it and then I'll pay attention to where my mind wanders, and wherever my mind wanders, I know I have a problem with the song right at that point. So I'll go back and I'll try to trim some fat there somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that because of Guy Clark. So we finished that song and he said, now let's book an appointment. Let's get together in a couple months again, and we'll go over the song and see how it sits. I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess we're painting with oil and not acrylic. So it needs to sit. It needs to cure for 6 months before it's actually truly dry. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, 3 or 4 months later, we get back together. We go to his place and we go over the song and we sort of tweak a couple things. We didn't have to change that much. And I sort of go to the washroom or something. I come back and he's standing in the window looking out into his backyard. And his house was kind of like on this little hill and looked down over this valley. And it's really nice. And he sort of looking out the window. And I sort of said, beautiful day, huh? He goes, yeah, sure is. And then he says, a couple smart guys would be golfing right now. And I said, you're preaching the converted, man. I got my clubs in the car. He goes, let's go. And I can't even believe, but 10 minutes later, we're standing on the first tee at this golf course playing 9 holes of golf. I'm playing with Guy Clark.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just the craziest thing. And so we play 9 holes of golf, and I'm just dumbfounded. We didn't even start a new song or anything like that. And so we do that, and that's just bizarre. And then so we finish 9 holes, and Levy says, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I said, "I don't know. Do you want to golf some more?" I said, "Yeah, I'm in." It's one of two things: he either enjoyed golfing with me, or he hated writing with me so much that he said, "Maybe I could do something else with this guy. Christ, he can't write." So then the next day we play 18 holes of golf, and so. And so can you just, picture, Guy Clark standing on the first tee? So we show up at the first tee, and there's these two guys waiting on the first tee. So we're being, like, hitched up with another twosome. So we all introduce ourselves, and we're walking along, and we're playing golf and chain-smoking. And we get to, like, we're on the back nine somewhere, and the guy's off in a bunker somewhere swinging away. And the guy comes in, one of the guys at the golf course says, "Is that Guy Clark?" I said, "Yeah, man, can you believe it?" He goes, "I can't even believe I'm golfing with Guy Clark." I said, "You and me both." But it was just a crazy thing. I had a feeling that they knew who he was when he pulled up to the first tee there, but they just, at the same time, they couldn't believe that it was actually Guy. This is the guy who wrote Homegrown Tomato. He's on the golf course with it. Are you kidding me?
Was he a good golfer, at least?
I'm sure he was fine. I don't really remember. I'm sure he, not like everybody else, shot somewhere in the, you know, mid-90s, you know, maybe high-90s.
Yeah.
Like they say, if it's any hotter than that, you don't bother going out anyway. And I'll tell you what the other, just the other cool story. So when we were sort of wrapped up, best job I ever had on that first day, he said, "Let's play some songs." I said, "Yeah, okay." Did I tell you this story?
No.
I don't know if I told you this story. He said, "Let's play some songs." I said, "Okay." And so he says, he didn't say I'll go first, but he went first. And he said, "Do you know that song I'm playing, like Desperado's Waiting on a Train?" I said, "Yeah." He's like hanging out with McCartney. He said, "Do you know that song I'm playing Yesterday?" "Yeah." "No shit, Dick Tracy." So he goes, "Do you know that song I'm playing, Desperado's Waiting on a Train?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Do you want to hear it?" Yes. So we're sitting like nose to nose at this table, and he plays like Desperado's Waiting on a Train. Just me and him. And I thought, oh, my God, this is just the craziest thing. And he says, "Play me one of yours." I'm like, "No, now this is ridiculous. This isn't even fair." Because if it was like me and another guy, like swapping songs, and he said, "Play me one of yours," I probably would have played one of guys and told him I wrote it.
You
know, yeah. So like, here's a song I wrote called, you know, whatever, Rita Ballou. So he said, "Play me one of yours." And so, you know, I know exactly what I played him. I played him Mr. Ever Was a Fool. And that was the one song that I can... off the top of my head, I thought, that's got a good lyric, and maybe he'll like it. I don't know. It's in a minor key. And so he listened to it, and he really listened to it.
Yeah.
And when I finished, he goes, "You know what, that's a really good..." He didn't say, "You know what?" He said, "That's a good song, man." And that's all he had to say. And, I can guarantee you he has swapped songs with way better. You know what I mean? I'm sure when Towns trotted out, Poncho and Lefty for him the first time, it was probably in the same kind of setting, sitting across from each other. And, so, yeah, I'm sure he's heard better and certainly more classic songs, at a kitchen table.
Yeah.
So it was great. And so that was fun. And then he said it to me. He says, "Do you know that song of mine, She Ain't Going Nowhere, She's Just Leaving?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Do you want to hear it?" I said, "Yeah, of course." And I said, so then he tried, "She ain't going nowhere, she's just leaving. She ain't going nowhere, she can't believe in." Oh, my God. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And so that was just as fun as he could. He says, "Play me another one of your songs." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I play him another song of mine called The Back of My Hand.
Yeah.
About this girl who works in a restaurant, in like a roadside diner. And in the last verse, there's a line that says, "Someday her Romeo will come. And until that day, she'll carry on. Ain't nothing new when you've seen it all twice before." And so I finished the song. He goes, "That's a good song, man." He goes, but "one thing." I said, "Yeah, what's that?" He goes, "We all know it's her Romeo. You don't even need the word her. Because someday Romeo will come." And I thought, oh, my God. That is just, it was like, that's how you trim fat, man.
Yeah.
We don't need to say, "Someday her Romeo will come. Someday Romeo will come. Until that day she'll carry on."
Little things like that that you'd never even really think about, eh?
Yeah, and it was just like, that's why, like, when you said, "Pack up all your dishes, make note of all good wishes," that is why it was so profound. Like, it was just like these little perfect, it's like putting a stone in the water and letting the water rush over it for 1,000 years. And you have this perfectly smooth stone. That's what Guy Clark's songs are like.
Yeah.
Perfect little 3-minute, slices of perfection.
Yeah.
And so I took that with me, and I carried that with me. And so then I finished that song, and I play that song, and he tells me that line, and I'm thinking, well, I will never forget that. And then he says, the last thing he says to me, Do you know that song of mine, The Randall Knife? You know this part of the story?
No.
So he said, you know that song of mine, The Randall Knife? I said, oh, my God. You know the song, Randall Knife?
Oh, I know. So, yeah.
It's like one of the best songs ever written.
Absolutely.
And so I'm thinking, oh, my God, he's going to play this song for me. And I said, it's one of my favorite songs ever. He goes, do you want to see it? I said, The Randall Knife? He goes, yeah, right here. And he reaches down into this drawer, this bottom drawer. And he opens up the drawer, reaches in, and he pulls out The Randall Knife. And there it was in it's like leather sheath.
Yeah.
And he hands it to me. And I said, can I take it out? And he goes, yeah, go ahead. And I take it out. And there's that half inch taken off of it.
Yeah.
When he stuck it in a tree, Boy Scouts Jamboree.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was like the icing on the cake. I mean, what do you do? How do you top that? You know? And it was like, this all happened in the space of like 6 or 8 hours or something.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Wow.
You know, and yeah, it was great. It was so much fun. Sorry for talking to you.
No, not a problem. It's a tremendous story. We thank you for sharing. We're going to play those songs, pretty much both of them, I think. Do you have a favorite version of The Randall Knife? Do you like the Dublin Blues version or one of the live versions?
Yeah, that's the version I like.
Yeah? All right.
Yeah. How about you? Which one do you like?
I don't know. I always like the live ones personally, but
yeah. I don't really have any. I don't think I've heard any live versions of. I mean, the only live album hit I have is Keepers.
Yeah, it's not on there.
No, it's not on there, but the song that reminds me the most of that, and it's even the same, very similar melody, is Let 'Em Roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, like, that's a song to me, like, every time I hear Let 'Em Roll, and when you get to that line, she used to be a whore in Dallas.
Yeah.
Every time I hear that line, and I know it's coming, but every time I hear that line, like, my chest, my chin drops to my chest.
Yeah.
I can't believe, you know... I just can't believe. And there's Alice, man. She. Oh my God! It just. I get chills right now just talking about it. But every time.
I know.
It's just. You know it's coming.
Yeah.
It's like watching when you see a scene of a movie. You know, it's like, you know it's coming. You just can't even believe. Just how much soul there is in that one little. That one little moment of time, but when you know, and we're all standing there and. Oh, what, you know, the girl there with, you know, way off in the side, you know, it's, oh my God, that's when I judged, her name's Alice, she used to be a whore in Dallas. Oh my God, I can't even, I start crying now. But like every time he hits that, it's just, like to me, of all his songs, Let 'Em Roll, when he says that line, it just takes the wind out of the room.
It is a magical thing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's play The Randall Knife, and then She Ain't Going Nowhere, and we'll slip in Best Job I Ever Had. And thanks, Mike. It is always a ton of fun to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. I'm going to see you in 6 weeks or something.
I am very much looking forward to that, my friend.
You and I are going to be drinking like idiots on one of those nights, aren't we?
Something like that, yeah.
We should. We should go all guy and downs on Winnipeg.
Yeah, well, it's going to be at somebody else's house, so we can trash the place as much as we want.
Before. I think I'm getting in the night before. Or no, the night after, even. I think I might be hanging around. We'll figure it out.
Perfect.
But, you know, we'll go. We'll do some games. Like, we'll walk up to somebody and say, how much you get in your pocket?
I'll make sure I only have $12 on me at the time.
Yeah, because otherwise you are in big trouble.
Although $12 Canadian isn't as good as yours probably was. But.
Well, pretty close, though.
Yeah. All right, thanks, man.
Thank you so much, sir. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah, get back to that birthday party and have some fun.
That's right, man.
Although I know what those girls' birthday parties are like, and you're probably having way more fun in the car.
I'm sitting here like looking at the party across the way, and I'm drinking a beer, and life is good. Am I allowed to say drinking a beer on the radio?
You can say whatever you want. We're campus and community radio.
When there's nothing else around, it'll have to do. Think Michelob.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
My father had a Randall knife. My mother gave it to him. When he went off to World War II to save us all from ruin. Now, if you've ever held a Randall knife, you know my father well. If a better blade was ever made, it was probably forged in hell. Well, my father was a good man. Was a lawyer by his trade. Only once did I ever see him misuse the blade. Well, it almost cut his thumb off when he took it for a tool. Ah, the knife was made for darker things, and you could not bend the rules. Well, he let me take it camping once on a Boy Scout jamboree. I broke a half an inch off trying to stick it in a tree. Well, I hid it from him for a while, but the knife and he were one. And he put it in his bottom drawer without a hard word. There it slept, and there it stayed for 20-some-odd years. Sort of like Excalibur, except waiting for a tear. Died when I was 40, and I couldn't find a way to cry. Not because I didn't love him, not because he didn't try. Well, I'd cried for every lesser thing, for whiskey, pain, and beauty. But he deserved a better tear, and I was not quite ready. So we took his ashes out to sea and poured them off the stern. And then through the roses in the wake of everything we'd learned. And when we got back to the house, they asked me what I wanted. Not the law books, not the watch. I need the thing he's haunted. Oh, my hand burned for the Randall knife there in the bottom drawer. And I found a tear for my father's life and all that it stood for. Thank you.
Well, it's a, once again, it's as true as I could possibly make it. I mean, I have the knife. It was just kind of a cathartic thing when my father died. I would have never thought about it being a song. It was just a poem that I'd written about 2 weeks after he died. I was talking to Rodney about it, Rodney Crowell, and we were getting ready to do a record. And I tried a couple of different ways to do it. I tried to actually have a melody and be a song, and it just, you know, it was too weird like that. So I just did it as a spoken piece, and I'm still surprised that people get it, you know, because it's so inside and it's so personal. And, you know, I got 3 or 4 knives with the tips broken off that people gave me because of their father, you know. I mean, it's a powerful piece, and on one level I understand why, and on another I don't.
Well, I'd like to thank my parents for all the shape I'm in. Well, pardon my condition, my excuse is pretty thin. Well, all I wanted was a car when I turned 16. But my folks bought me a guitar, and it'll be the death of me. Well, I could have been a doctor or even an astronaut. Well, hell, I could have been most anything if it weren't for this dreadnought. But when I got down to it and I learned the chords C, F, and G, well, I hit the road with my guitar, and it'll be the death of me. And it's the best job I've ever had. You spend half your time tuning them and the other half playing out of tune. And it's the best job I've ever had. It's the best job I've ever had. Guitars make life bearable. There ain't another job in the world comparable. And it's the best job I've ever had. Well, it's gotten me into some tight spots, and it's gotten me out of a few. And if it wasn't for the music, well, I don't know what I'd do. But if you have to tell the truth, well, then you have to have the tools. So get yourself a guitar, and it'll be the death of you. 'Cause it's the best job I've ever had. One night in Kansas City, it got broken in a fight, and I glued it back together, and it ain't never been right. But it's the best job I've ever had. It's the best job I've ever had. You wanna know why people play guitar all day long and act a fool just for a song? It's the best job they've ever had. It's the best job I've ever had. And I know why Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil down on Highway 61. 'Cause it's the best job he ever had. When I die and I get to heaven, I'm gonna tell you what. I may have seen and done a lot of things, but there's still things that I have not. But what I did, and I did it the most true, was play this fucking guitar. And I played it all for you.
There's Mike Plume, co-written by Guy Clark. I always meant to ask Mike about that last line. I don't think Guy would have written that last line. I don't know. We'll have to ask him. He's stopping in July, as he said. We'll talk about that. and much more. We got one more great story coming up after a short break. Stick with us. Tell the band to go home. We'll return.